1999 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session 335, a panel discussion entitled The LDS Church in the World of Issues, but Not of It, with panelists Ted Wilson, Catherine Carr, and David Jones.
Wilson, I'm the director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah. And our panel this morning is The LDS Church in the World, but Not of It, of Issues. A play on another phrase that comes out of the church. And I'd like to begin by introducing our panelists who are with us this morning. We're fortunate to have some people who are absolutely terrific in what they do in life, and I think can shed a great deal of light on these issues. First of all, let me start with Michael Bielson, who's on the end there. Mike is a deacon in the Roman Catholic Church. He's assigned to the St. Joseph Parish of Ogden. He's an attorney at Utah Legal Services. He's been there for 20 years. He specializes in Social Security, disability, and related benefits. He has his Juris Doctorate from the University of Denver. He's a Master in International Studies from the University of Denver also, and a Master's in Pastoral Studies from Loyola University. He's married and has two sons. Michael is also a member of the Peace and Justice Commission, which is sanctioned by the Catholic Church to become involved in various kinds of issues, which is mainly a lay commission. Michael's been quite active in issues that have propped up in Utah, including the issue of guns in churches. Sitting next to him is Catherine Carr. Catherine is an administrator at the University of Utah, the assistant director of Resident Life. If you've seen those brand new apartments going up there by Fort Douglas, Catherine has a lot to do with those, and as students begin to move in, she will be greatly involved in that. She has a tremendous interest in child care. She has a Master's of Public Administration from the University of Utah, a bachelor's degree in interpersonal group communication from the University of Utah, and she's written many newsletter articles regarding student life and child care, and has done many other interesting things that will allow us to bring that important issue into focus this morning. Next is Ben McAdams, who is the new student body president at the University of Utah. Ben has been a student of mine for a couple of years. He's a terrific young man. He's an advanced man for President Clinton, and it's not unusual to get a call from Kosovo or somewhere, as I did a couple of Sundays ago, as he was in one of the refugee camps with President. It actually wasn't Kosovo. It was Macedonia, right on the border, however, and I think he was actually across the border at one point into Kosovo. Has had a tremendous amount of interest in social reform, social welfare, social issues, and took particular interest in the church's statement, I say the church's, at least the statement of Elder Marlon Jensen, that it's okay to be a Democrat, which made all 14 Democrats in Utah, including myself, very happy. So Ben will probably reflect on that very important issue today. The fourth member of our panel, and of course politicians are always late, so please don't glare at him when he comes in, is Representative David Jones, the minority leader at the Utah State Legislature. David's had a lot to do with gun issues and is involved with quite a dispute right now with Mari Stevens, the Speaker of the House, over whether there ought to be a special session and other things regarding the gun issue, which came out of the terrible incident at Columbine High School. So David will be here in just a moment. He is a businessman. He's worked with Walker Associates. He's now involved in his own business consulting, and he's running for mayor of Salt Lake City. Poor pity the poor guy. Doesn't know what he's going to get into. And I'm one of the few guys that can say that. So let me start with my introduction, and then if we could, we'll start with Michael and then go to Catherine, then to Ben and Dave as he comes in. And I'll move my brief so David feels welcome. There is nothing in the separation of the church and state doctrine under the Constitution of the United States that would prohibit a church from being active in politics. The doctrine rather creates a firewall, as it was termed by the Supreme Court, between the organization of churches and government, and doesn't allow money to pass back and forth and so forth. But churches as entities are free to exercise political persuasion in any way they wish. They can endorse candidates, though they don't often. they can provide money for causes, and they can do many, many other things. Now, tax law does prohibit a church to take money given to the church for ecclesiastical reasons and use that in the activity of politics. And I've sometimes heard that the Mormon Church has stepped out of bounds when it donates to Alaska gay rights issues, or perhaps one coming up in California or Hawaii and so forth. I think most of that money was raised privately within the organization of the church, or it came from the profit side of the church where taxes are paid. So I'm not so sure the church is culpable in those particular issues in terms of the tax law. The LDS Church appears to be involved in politics in several different ways. I've made an attempt to try to classify them based on my own observations, and this may be a very poor classification, but let me just take a stab at it. The most important method is bottom-up. I'll call this method one. That is, the values and attitudes of rank-and-file Mormons serve to deeply influence election and governmental actions in areas where membership in the church comprises a large political constituency, like Utah, where the number of members in the state, well, of course, this would include inactives, is about 70%, runs around the 70% figure. The leadership of the church is apparently uncomfortable with this phenomenon, as it tends to link the church, culturally more than politically, to the Republican Party. The church, in fact, has tried to deal with that in recent years by various statements, and, of course, the most potent one being the statement of Elder Marlon Jensen in 1998, which I think Ben will be talking about here today. Number two, the next method is what I call behind the scenes. The church seeks to influence politics and government, but attempts to do so quietly so that the word does not get out. The law firm Curtin and McConkie, for example, represents the church quietly lobbying at the state legislature. But if any of you have had anything to do with the state legislature, you know that that lobby, though quiet, is very powerful. The best example that I can think of in this category goes back to 1984, when the church influenced the killing of a proposed flat tax at the Utah State Legislature. The flat tax would have not allowed charitable deductions for contributions under the Utah State Tax Code to religious organizations. Obviously, the church had an interest. They chose to do that very quietly, and the timber fell on that issue very quickly at the legislature as Curtin McConkie spoke out on it. Number three, the next method is to be present on an issue but to leave cloudy exactly who is responsible. In this category, this leaves the plausible deniability to various leaders and layers of the church command structure. An example would be church donations or getting the priesthood to lead private donations, as generally the case would be, to state initiatives such as contributions to anti-gay marriage actions in Hawaii, Alaska, California, and so forth. Local priesthood leaders take the direct action. If they were called by someone at 47 East South Temple, the word is not out on that. We're not sure exactly how the link up. So it leaves it sort of unclear who's in charge. This method, to a degree, although in a more direct way, was used in the statement of Marlon Jensen about Democrats. It was clear that was coming from the upper reaches of the church, but they chose someone who was in the First Council of the 70 rather than someone on the Council of the 12 or at the First Presidency level, thus leaving a smaller but some measure of deniability. If Marlon went too far in his statement, for example, as I think some people maybe think he did, then the upper church leaders could kind of say, well, that was Marlon. You know, he had a few things to say, and he's an old Democrat. Number four, the next method, and I'm not trying to belittle the church at all. I think this is what's really happening. That's for the press if they're here. The next method, number four, is for particular top leadership, usually members of the Council of the 12 now going up the authority tree, to make a direct statement or public statement on an issue. Though such a statement does not take on the elements of a reported directive from God, as one from the First Presidency might, it makes it pretty certain that the United Church leadership is behind it. A good example would be the statements of Cecil Ballard and Alexander Morrison that we should not have guns in churches and that the legislature ought to do something about it. It's pretty clear that came almost from the top or from the top. Five, the next method is when the church deems a public issue to be, quote, moral. And by the way, this is a construct, I think, from this century, the middle to the late part of the century. Church didn't worry about that in the earlier days. And when the church declares an issue to be moral, it jumps in with both feet. There have been several issues like this in Utah, including the condemnation of the MX missile, one of the few divergents to the left. You might remember that issue. And direct opposition to initiatives on liquor by the drink, parimutuel betting, and in other states, so I don't think it's come up directly in Utah, opposition to gay marriage. Several of these issues include direct statements from the first presidency, causing some to speculate God inspires them. Now, the church, for example, in the MX missile situation, signed a letter from all of the first presidency, but they did not say it was a revelation. They simply made it as a political comment. But I heard in my ward people saying things like, well, God must have spoken on that when it came from all of the top three of the church. So that lends itself to some speculation. The final method is direct revelation concerning issues that might both have internal church doctrinal implications and will also affect the church relationship to the outside world in a political sense. Examples in this category are the Polygamy Manifesto of Wilford Woodruff, and some still do not read that as revelation, including polygamists who find some comfort in there that it didn't directly go right to the issue of polygamy, and the statement of the presidency of Spencer W. Kimball changing the church position on priesthood for all worthy male members, which, of course, included blacks and other people of color. So that's a kind of a final method where they make it very clear that the church is speaking, in a sense, from God. Because the church wishes to retain its independence, it does not participate in ecumenical public statements on public issues. In fact, the church rarely participates in an ecumenical way, in a formal ecumenical way. Certainly it does informally on many occasions. Recent general authorities did meet with representatives from many other churches, including, I think, Michael's organization, the Peace and Justice Commission of the Catholic Church, on the issue of guns in churches. But the church chose not to join the group when Bishop Carolyn Tanner Irish of the Episcopal Church led a group to meet with Governor Leavitt on the issue. Instead, it issued its own statement, which I have referred to previously. Because of the desire to retain independence on issues, and the church deals with the appearance of being too powerful, particularly in Utah, the church often uses political methods that create plausible deniability for its leaders. Now, in the cases of methods, I would say, 2, 3, and 4, and sometimes 5, that can cause confusion among the membership and the general public as to where the church really stands. So with that rather crude, quick attempt to classify church actions, let me turn to Michael Buelson to talk about his experience. Michael?
Thank you, Ted. This is my first experience here with your Sunstone Symposium. I've read a lot about it in the paper. When I got here, I realized I was one of the most overdressed people here. You're a very informal, casual group, and that's great. If I had known that, I would have come more casual. But I felt right at home when I looked at the program and saw you chose as the theme, Faith Seeking Understanding, a quote, of course, from St. Anselm, Fides Quaerens Intellectum, which is one of my favorite quotes, which is what we're all about, of course. I also saw a lot of humor sprinkled throughout your program and listening to folks around here, and so I wanted to tell you a little story from the Roman Catholic side. It seems that the Pope was in the Vatican one morning, and one of his aides, a cardinal, came running in and said, Holy Father, I have good news and bad news. And of course, the Pope says, well, tell me the good news first. He says, well, the good news is, Jesus just called on the phone. He's returned to the earth. And the Pope says, well, what could be the bad news? He I said, well, the bad news is he's calling from Salt Lake City. So I want to thank you for inviting me and to share my thoughts with you on this subject of the Mormon Church in the world of issues but not of it, and my perspective as a Roman Catholic. The Roman Catholic Church, and in particular the bishops of the United States, have a lengthy record of involvement in the political arena in an effort to help create a society more in harmony with the gospel of Christ and to promote the common good of all people. The Catholic Church has a lengthy teaching tradition on social justice issues, starting with Pope Leo XIII in 1891, who issued the first papal encyclical, which is a letter from the Pope to the Church, to the bishops and all the faithful, called Rerum Novarum, the New Age, which called for improved conditions for workers in the world. Now, every pope since that has added to that tradition with statements covering a broad spectrum of social issues, labor unions, world peace, disarmament, capitalism, the death penalty, the effects of technology, and many others. And in this country, the Catholic bishops have issued pastoral statements on such topics as nuclear weapons and the U.S. economy. The U.S. Catholic Conference of Bishops maintains an active presence in Washington, D.C., where it supports regular lobbying on issues affecting Catholic interests and values. So why is the Catholic Church involved in the political arena in this way? Well, I think our involvement arises from our theology. We are an incarnational church. We believe that God became incarnate in the world through Jesus Christ, and that Christ remains in the world. We believe that Christ is uniquely present in the world through the poor, the weak, the disadvantaged, the marginalized, the powerless. He is present in those who lack access to power, who do not have the means to bring about change. And Mother Teresa probably said it most simply and most eloquently when she said, Christ is present in the world, hidden behind the terrible disguise of the poor. So if we choose to serve Christ, then we must take care of the poor. If we want to take care of the poor, we must be involved in the political arena, for that is where change is brought about. Let me give you one recent example. I attended this past week a public hearing before the State Medical Care Advisory Committee, which, among other things, advises the governor and the state legislature on matters concerning the health care budget. There was a young disabled man there, afflicted with Parkinson's disease and shaking, and he was testifying that he had to spend about half of his limited Social Security disability benefits each month just to purchase a monthly Medicaid card. And he pleaded with the committee members to do something so that he would not have to make these monthly choices between food and medical care. And the committee members listened politely, but noted that what he was asking for would require a legislative change, that it would cost money, and it was likely it would not happen. Only action in the political arena could help that poor man suffering from Parkinson's disease. And that is why I am involved in such organizations, as Ted mentioned, the Peace and Justice Commission, which lobbies on behalf of people like this young man for changes in our healthcare system. Now, when it comes to gun control, we might ask, who are the poor and the vulnerable we are concerned about in this area? And I think it is our children. During the 1980s, the number of guns in our society quadrupled. During that same time, 50,000 American teenagers and children were killed by guns, matching the number who died in Vietnam. The American bishops noted that In most of our cities and rural areas, purchasing a weapon is as easy as buying a camera. And all of that occurred a decade before Columbine High School. And so we have to reflect on the reality that Christ did not carry a weapon, concealed or otherwise, and in my opinion, neither should we. And to think that by arming ourselves, by allowing concealed weapons in our schools and churches, we will be more secure is simply an illusion. If we are to be faithful to the gospel of Christ, if we are to take care of Christ in the world, disguised this time in the form of vulnerable children, then we must say, enough. Only fear, mistrust, and more violence will follow the spread of concealed weapons. Let me close by saying, before God brought the Israelites into the promised land, he spoke to them in these words, "I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day, that I have set before you life and death, blessing and curse. Choose life, that you and your descendants may live. By opposing the spread of guns, we choose life." Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. And we'll go to Catherine Carr now. Catherine?
You want me to help you pass those out?
I apologize to Mike for leaving for a minute, but I went out to see if I could find my soapbox. I'm talking on child care issues, which is a soapbox matter. I would say perhaps it becomes more of a soapbox matter because children are very much unable to speak for themselves. There are advocates, and I would say to all of you, not by a show of hands, but would you please, within your own mind and heart, say, "I really like and care about children." Now, maybe a show of hands of any of you in here who really do not care about children. I don't think we'd see a hand anywhere. Then we come to the situation of, I raised my children. I got them through the school system. I didn't have any help. If I can do it, our parents of today can do it. I paid my tax money to raise my children. Now I'm a little tired of paying all my taxes in so that the schools can provide the education necessary for our children, kindergarten through 12. You hear this issue many, many times where people don't want to pay the money in. Now, you might ask, and I'll get to touch on that, but I would like to have you follow with me for just a minute, if you would. Today's young America is in a terrible situation. It is difficult. I'm afraid I didn't keep one of those green ones, and I need one. Do we have one left over? Please. I apologize. See, if I had my soapbox here, I wouldn't be flustered. How does this relate to what's going on actually childcare-wise in our world today? Right on the front of this green, I was delighted to find this statement by our Lieutenant Governor, Olene Walker, because it says so much of what is really going on for our young people today. I work at the University of Utah in the Resident Life Program for the Family Housing. I see young mothers coming in as single parents trying to get a degree to help themselves get through college so that they can have a career line type work that will help them to better themselves and their family as time goes on and hopefully to be able to take their children on to, if not higher education, at least a choice of education and not a job they have to do just because they want to make the money. And Olene in here talks about, and this please note that all of this information I've handed you is 1998, prior to the last legislative session, when so much of the child care legislation that was done was undone as far as licensing goes. Olean talks about 63.5% of Utah women working outside the home. Now, I get hit all the time from church comments that, well, the woman's place is in the home. The women don't belong out of the home. They need to stay home and take care of their children. 2 points. First, many women can't stay at home and still have food on the table. They must go outside of the home. When their child care costs up to 50% of their income, where does the rent come from? Where does the food come from? If these women are making enough money to be outside of the welfare reimbursement, they can't make it because we don't have child care for these women. Now, when I talk about child care, I'm talking not just about somebody to watch your child run around and do whatever, or your grandchild. I'm talking about quality, affordable, education-based care for these children that a loving, nurturing care would give. And I'm challenging us today, as you read through some of this information, to pay attention to the myths about child care. Pay attention to the facts as you hear them. Obviously, on this soapbox, there is not time for me to go into the arguments pro and con about child care. What I would like to do is move very quickly to potential solution. We provide public schooling for our children from kindergarten through 12. At 12 years old, children usually are old enough and capable enough to maybe get a job and help themselves a little bit. We as a society recognized many, many years ago that our responsibility for our children was to provide a public education system so that every child had the opportunity to attend, to learn. The literacy in this country is greater than most other countries. Our children know how to read, most of them. You hear the horror stories, but for the most part, we have wonderful students. We have pretty good schools. Utah is not on the cutting edge of those schools at times. That's another issue. The fact is we provide that. In today's society, we provide the schooling for K through 12 as public. However, if you're affluent enough and you want a private school, you have that option. If you're not affluent and you are on child welfare, your child will qualify for food so that they have nutrition. So the general idea is that it works. If you are on welfare, your child can, or you can get assistance for your child for child care, infancy through 5 or 6 years old, if you are on welfare. In the blue document I passed out on the third page in, you will see, or is it the fourth page? I beg your pardon. Fourth page in, I think it's mark number 3. You'll see a story about Jennifer. This is not untypical for what I see coming through our university system today. The legislature has changed some of the rulings, or the law of welfare have changed so that persons, men or women, seeking a degree, a higher education degree, may not receive child care, even if they are qualified for welfare payments or housing subsidies. This is very difficult because then these people have to leave their university or their higher education to go out into the workforce to be what I will call a support system laborer, and they don't have the opportunity then for a career line. These are issues that we need to face. So what happens then to the affluent child, infant through K, where the mother either chooses to work or the father, or they are going to be out there? What happens to those children? Well, perhaps they can afford the child care that I'm speaking about, the quality, affordable, education-based child care. But then guess what we have left? We have the middle America. And I would almost guarantee you that most of us in this room and most of us around fit into that category when you consider that child care on a reasonable base for one child costs $5,000 to $15,000 a year for that age group. If they're infants, it's more because the ratios have to be 4 infants for one person. Here is my proposal. And I loved Mike's comment when he said, It will require legislative change. It will cost money, and it likely will not happen. Here's my challenge. Other churches have stepped forward. They have child care in their churches. Corporations have stepped forward. They have child care in their corporations, or they make benefits for their people. My point is, those are Band-Aids. They do not answer the need for this group of people in the middle. We need to provide, society needs to provide, our churches need to support, and our legislature needs to redirect or find monies that will provide the option of child care from the age of infancy through K, the same as we do for our older ones. More than half of our population of women and more than three-quarters of our men are in the workforce, and those children are being lost. The children are our future. I brought a couple of overheads I want to share with you today. Oh, and I'm right there. Again, if I may very briefly just make the challenge that it is societies, it is churches, it is our responsibility as citizens and taxpayers to try to get the funds that come in from our tax monies to develop child care, infant through the beginning of grade school. Not as a requirement, this is not socialistic, this is not government intervention, it's an option that will protect our children in this middle area and at least give them an opportunity to learn and grow in a safe environment while their parents are out doing what we all must do, make a living. Thank you for letting me come.
We'll now go to Ben McAdams, the president of the student body at the University of Utah.
Thanks, Ted. First of all, I wanted to start off talking about part of my involvement in politics. I remember early on when I started becoming, you know, interested in politics and actually just getting involved in the system, I remember reading a scripture in the Doctrine and Covenants that says that we believe that we're instituted of God for the benefit of man and that he holds men accountable for their actions in relation to them, both in making laws and administering them for the good and safety in society. And so, you know, as we kind of try to discuss and understand the church's involvement in politics and individual members of the church and why they get involved in politics, one of the issues why I'm involved, and I think many, you know, regardless of denomination, why people get involved in government is because we believe that government exists for the benefit of man, and as the Doctrine and Covenants says, for the good and safety of society. And I believe we are held accountable before God for our actions with government and for our actions or lack of actions with getting involved. In early January of 1998, the first presidency issued a statement calling for. It basically said, you know, calling for members to get involved in the political process and to make their voices heard and to face up to this responsibility to get involved. And some of the wording, which looking back now I kind of find it humorous, but it was very, very powerful for me at the time. It said that we encourage members of the church to get involved in the political party of their choice. Now at that point I was already a Democrat, but to find out that I had a choice was very comforting. And now looking back, that is pretty humorous that I had a choice. But I do have a choice, and I've made my choice. The sad side of that statement, while giving me more enthusiasm and comfort to get involved in the Democratic Party and to get involved in political process, the downside was is the Republicans came out in droves and ran for office. But you know, there's give and take, I guess, in everything. Later that year, I believe it was in early May of 1998, the Salt Lake Tribune did a follow-up article with Marlon Jensen to discuss the church coming out and actually encouraging political diversity. And Marlon Jensen made some comments that, you know, I remember I was actually at the time I was serving a Hinckley internship in the White House and had one of my friends who was working over in Senator Hatch's office call up and said that, hey, I've got something for you. You're going to find it incredible. And she faxed it over. I remember standing in the White House press office receiving this fax with the transcript of Marlon Jensen's comments, which really was monumental. He said, quote, I think the perception that our leaders had is that that as individual church members, we're maybe not quite living up to our obligation to become good citizens, or we're not living up to the obligation that the Doctrine and Covenants gives to us. He goes on to say, the letter reflects a general concern worldwide that it is really part of our religion to be good citizens and to do our share in the community. It is probably related doctrinally in a way to the idea that we're not just here to build up the kingdom of God, but we're also here to establish his righteousness. The church, as much as it may appear otherwise, is not a Republican church. The church has stated several times that we want the best women and best men, not necessarily of our faith, but the best men and women to get involved in the process. I remember speaking with, right around the time as the church was coming out and starting to push for political diversity, I remember speaking with Megan Holbrook, and she was saying that the first presidency had called her in. Megan Holbrook is the chair of the State Democratic Party. The church presidency, she had a meeting with the church presidency, and they were asking her specifically, what can we do to help you? It was around the time that the Democratic Party hadn't put up a candidate against Chris Cannon, and the church was becoming very concerned about the cultural ties between the Church of Jesus Christ and the Republican Party, and they were asking Megan specifically, what can we do to help strengthen the party, to help encourage the Democratic Party in Utah? And Megan asked for them to call Orrin Hatch on a mission. So the church may not be doing everything they can, but I do appreciate what they are doing. Marlon Jensen went on to say that we regret more than anything that there would become a church party and a non-church party. And because a national, he went on to kind of elaborate, saying because a national party may take stands the church does not necessarily agree with, that is not a reason why a member of the church cannot affiliate itself with that political party. I believe that the church, we as individual members of the church, get involved in politics because it is our responsibility. Recently in the news and in recent politics, we've heard a new term come into play. It's compassionate conservatism. And I heard President Clinton once say that this is nothing more than a good word preceded by a bad word. Or I'm sorry, the other way around, a bad word preceded by a good word. I think that kind of goes why I have decided to get involved in politics. As I returned from a mission, I served a mission in São Paulo, Brazil, and as I saw the utter poverty juxtaposed with more wealth than I've ever seen here in the United States, and I realized the need for somebody to get involved to level the playing field, to provide an equal opportunity for all. And compassion became part the major reason that I decided to get involved in politics. And as much as this may be a surprise, my mission is what made me a Democrat. Now, to get more involved in the church collectively, I've spoken about how the church individually, church members, get involved in the political process. The church collectively takes a stand on politics. As I've looked at different issues, I saw two main categories why the church gets involved. One is to further its ideology, and two is to further its economic interests. As Ted mentioned, and so I won't go into detail, but the church has been involved very actively over the years, involved economically, both with the flat tax in 1984 in Utah. They were also involved in Colorado when Colorado was trying to pass a flat tax just a few years back. There was an instance in the late 1970s where the church was lobbying the federal government against airline deregulation, and the church had a major economic stance, major economic ties in that issue. But I do believe, I guess the third category that I've seen the church get involved in political issues is personal beliefs, and that's partially, I think, where the tie between the culturally Republican and the church has been misconstrued as church leaders speak out on their personal beliefs. Both President Grant came out and endorsed Richard Nixon for the presidential candidacy. President Benson made very many political statements that often were personal beliefs rather than official church doctrine. But I do see as the church is taking on a new position in the world arena, the stance of the church toward politics is changing. The church has been very vocal in the mid to late 1980s on political issues, but we also see the church being careful. As the church becomes more of an international church rather than solely a domestic church, we see the church, that now the church has a huge huge issues at stake in the international arena. In, I believe it was 1996, Alexander Lebed of Russia came out stating that, basically calling international denominations filth and scum, and the LDS Church became very involved lobbying the federal government to call into question U.S. funding for Russia. But also, as the church has been involved in the international arena, they've got to be careful, and I've seen them being careful internationally to avoid the appearance that we have a U.S. domestic-led political agenda that's taking place in the international arena. We've got to do this to avoid, to avoid anti-American sentiment. As Ted mentioned, I was just over recently in Macedonia working with the Clinton administration in the refugee camps, and the refugee camp that we were working in was sponsored by Catholic Relief Services, and the church with its international agenda has become more vocal and more involved in the international arena with Hurricane Mitch. They were very, very vocal in humanitarian causes. They've done some work with the refugees over in Kosovo and in the Balkans. But I foresee as the church becomes more international that we will begin to be more active in international humanitarian causes and tend to avoid more of the political issues. But I do believe, as much as the appearance to the contrary, that the church is not a Republican church, that the church does get involved on issues, and there have been issues on both sides of the political ideologies, but the church is not a Republican.
I've already introduced Dave, but he's usually out on the street corner waving at cars, so it's nice to get him off the streets where he's safe.
Nice to be here, I must say. Thank you very much. It's a great opportunity to be here. I had the chance to speak to Sunstone, I think, 2 or 3 years ago on a similar topic, and so it's nice to be back. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about my experience with the LDS Church. I'm not LDS. And as I tell my LDS friends, I'm not of your faith, but I am of your culture. I pretty much grew up in Utah, was raised in an Ogden area, and attended Boy Scouts in the LDS Church, and I know most of the hymns. And I have had a lot of interaction with LDS people over the years, and then also, you know, since I've been in the legislature. I came to the legislature in 1989. I've served there for a little over 10 years now. I am the minority leader of the House of Representatives, and in Utah code, that has to be a Democrat. Minority has to be a Democrat. So, in fact, my mother used to tease me when I told her that I'd become the minority leader of the House of Representatives. She says, "Is that a little bit like being the tallest building in Camas?" Or... I said, "Yeah." Yes. You know, I'm going to go out on a limb here and suggest that the LDS Church has a big role that it plays in Utah politics. And in fact, I'm going to suggest that it's not because they seek to dominate, it's because they are dominant. And there's not anything wrong with that. It's just a fact of life. It's kind of like an elephant who walks through anthills every now and then. And it's... I think that they choose to wield their influence on some issues. They choose to wield their influence not on other issues. In the vast majority of issues that come before the Utah legislature, the LDS Church has no role whatsoever. They take no position. They make no communication whatsoever. And I would say that's probably 98% of the time. But when it does take a stand, when it does choose to wield some influence, I've noticed that they have a variety of ways of doing it. And the issues that, as I just sat down and thought about this a little bit, that they have chosen to wield influence in some way or another are just a few, and you mentioned a few also, but I'll try to hit the ones that you didn't mention. Liquor has been a big issue. Abortion has been a big issue. Gay and lesbian marriage has been an issue. Guns in schools and churches has been an issue, as well as access to guns by the mentally ill has been a recent issue. Crime has been an issue in an interesting way, and I'll talk about that. And also political balance, which Ben alluded to. And let me talk to you about the ways that I've observed they have chosen to wield their influence. And there's different ways depending on what the issue is. First of all, there is the method of public pronouncement of a principle. An example is guns in schools and churches. And the LDS Church has a statement on record that I don't know how you could misinterpret it. It's very clear, and they simply say that there is no place in churches for guns, concealed or otherwise. And I think it's unmistakable what their intent is. They also have a principle that they have articulated on the issue of abortion, and I won't try to repeat that because I don't remember it exactly. But that's typically something that I have seen over the years, is they will come out, they will make a statement, and they will put it out there, and then they're silent, and they let that stand for itself. Another method that they've employed is a public call for action. You don't see that too often. But the issue most recently on the heels of the shooting at the genealogy library had to do with the access of mentally ill people to weapons. And President Gordon B. Hinckley of the LDS Church made it very clear that he thought we needed to take action in this arena, that mentally ill people who have a record of violence have access to weapons and they shouldn't have access to weapons. And I think immediately following that, we started to see the governor of the state rethink whether or not he wanted to have a special session of the legislature. We saw the legislature kind of spring into action and suddenly call a 90-day review of gun issues. So that's one of the ways that influence is wielded. On certain occasions, they employ direct political action. And it doesn't happen very often. And sometimes it's more prevalent outside of our state than within our state. And I think that's for the reasons that that Ted articulated and a couple of the others, is that they know that they are dominant in the state and they don't need to push things too hard. In fact, they don't want to be criticized for that. But on the issue of gay marriages, the LDS Church took a very direct action in Hawaii and in Alaska in trying to defeat referendums, or I'm sorry, rather trying to support referendums that would oppose gay marriage. Another method is, and this is perhaps more subtle, is the dominance of key organizations or agencies or commissions within the state. And the most notable, in my view, is the State Liquor Control Commission. For years, that organization has been dominated by people who are, you know, very devout LDS people, and nothing happens on Capitol Hill unless the Liquor Control Commission gives it its blessing. And I don't think you'd find a legislator that would dispute that with me. Many times, liquor bills will come before the session, and there will be no discussion about them. They never make it out of the Rules Committee, or they never make it out of a legislative committee. And you pretty much get the idea that the time is not right for that issue, and so nothing happens. On other times, other occasions, it will move very quickly, and it basically the signal always comes from the State Liquor Control Commission. And I don't think that's coincidence. I think that's a very good example of how influence is wielded, but it's a little bit indirect. And it's on an issue that the church cares deeply about and considers to be a moral issue. Finally, another method, which I probably have had the most exposure to, is dialogue behind the scenes. And this issue is perhaps most prevalent. I've seen it most prevalent on the issue of crime, for example, and I'll talk a little bit about that, and on the issue of English as the official language of the state of Utah. As a legislator, I have never received a call from the LDS Church asking me not to do something or asking me to do something. What I have received are calls asking for clarification of information, calls asking for additional exploration of an idea, those types of things, and it's usually very similar to calls that I may receive from the Catholic Diocese as well, or from other interested organizations. So, as I say, I'm not a member of the LDS Church, so perhaps other members of the LDS Church do receive those kinds of calls. I haven't seen it, and I've had nobody ever tell me they have received that kind of a call. But a two-way street is there's a dialogue that occurs behind the scenes. And frequently, as the minority leader of the House, I will request a meeting with church elders, and this usually happens once a year in the spring or in January rather, before the session. And our leadership will go meet with members of the LDS leadership. I know the Republicans do the same thing. And I have found that to be a very productive meeting. And frankly, what it is just a frank and open discussion of issues that are coming up. We talk about what's on our mind. They sometimes talk about what is on their mind. We do the same thing in sitting down with the bishop of the Catholic Church on occasion. And we have done the same thing in sitting down with the bishop of the Episcopal Church, Bishop Irish. But what I think is interesting is that in Utah, because of this domination, it's very important that the dialogue occurs. And in the last meeting that we had, which was in January, I brought up the issue of crime in Utah. And we had seen some astounding figures. Utah now ranks 9th in the nation for overall crime on a per capita basis. We rank 1st in the nation for theft crime. We rank 6th in the nation for property crime, 12th in the nation for rape. Those numbers are, frankly, just astounding. And we brought those forward. We talked about that. And I could actually see that they were moved some action on this issue. We wanted to take some action on this issue. We were having a hard time getting the attention of the majority party on this issue because they were very concerned about finishing their road budget at the time. And so, but what I noticed is shortly after that the majority party started getting interested. And I started seeing KSL editorials and Deseret News editorials. And then pretty soon the Tribune was doing this stuff too. So, you know, they have a very big role that they play. It's not always overt. And in fact, most of the time it's not overt. But it's a role that I respect. And it's a role that I value. I have never felt that they have been overbearing, that they have tried to manipulate me or anything like that. I'm being perfectly honest with you. But I do feel that they have a vital interest. Now, I'll tell you, sometimes I have sought their help as well. And I remember during the session, because of this gun issue and because of the crime issue, I went down and had a conversation with Alexander Morrison of the LDS Church. Very, very progressive man, very bright man, and what a delight. And he is very concerned about these issues and wanting to push them. And I found that to be very helpful. We were able to come up with some ideas and move on those ideas. And so I would say that the LDS Church is a resource. It's a concerned entity. I always say that this is the greatest anchor tenant any city could ever have, the LDS Church in Salt Lake City. And I mean, it's a huge influence in Salt Lake. It's a huge influence in the Mountain West. We need to pay attention to it. We need to be respectful, and we need to recognize that they have interests, legitimate interests, and I think they are rather careful. I describe them as an elephant walking through an anthill, but I think it's better than that because I think they're very aware of those ants and they're cautious in where they put their feet. I'll finish up just with a notation referring back to Ben's observations about Megan Holbrook, the chairman of the State Democratic Party, going before the LDS elders. And I was the chairman of the Democratic Party for 2 years also, and when I first took office, I made that same pilgrimage, and I went to the public affairs office and had a chance to introduce myself, and at one point I said, "Gentlemen, I understand that at one point in your history, Brigham Young actually split the flock, said this half of the aisle is going to be Democrats, this half of the aisle is going to be Republicans." And they said, "Yes, that's true." And I said, "Well, would you consider respectfully doing it again?" So,
the way I heard that story was that the bishops were told to have the members count off. And he said, "All right, and they counted off." And he said, "All the Democrats will be even, and the Republicans have been odd ever since." Is that true?
I wasn't there.
You weren't there. Okay. Well, time has come for your questions, your statements, your input, your interaction with the panel here. If you'd like to address one member of the panel, that's fine. If not, just a general question is also okay.
I have one for all of you. But first, I want to give you the Episcopalian version of your story. A woman priest goes into the Archbishop of Canterbury's office in Lambeth Palace and said, "I've got a mixed message." And he says, "Oh, what's that?" And she says, "God is on the line." And the Archbishop said, "Oh?" And the woman priest says, "Yes, and she's calling from Salt Lake." And the Archbishop said, "What does she have to say?" And the woman priest says, "She's pissed." I want to ask about what happens when religious influence fails. And I have three examples. George Bush was an Episcopalian but chose to pray about the Gulf War with someone he agreed with because the Episcopal bishop of the church didn't. The Roman Catholic declarations on the economy that Bishop Rezazes Bill Buckley and other prominent Roman Catholics came out against it. And the ODS authorities have spoken on gun control, and the governor was booed by, presumably, good Mormons when he tried to support that. How do you account for this kind of negative influence? Is religion all that important after all?
Very good question. The Mormons were also asked to vote for Republicans during the Great Depression, and the saints did not listen. They voted for Democrats. They voted for FDR. Michael? Sorry, we just have one mic there.
Yeah, that's me. I'm the one mic. I'm always an optimist, Reverend. I know it. Sometimes it seems like those who speak to these issues from the standpoint of religion may seem like, you know, the voice crying in the wilderness. But changes do occur. And if we reflect on our own tradition, I'll reflect on my own tradition in the Catholic Church. You know, you think of what has happened in the area of civil rights in a very short time. And by a short time, in the context of the Roman Catholic Church, a century or two. The Roman Catholic Church was not in the lead in opposing slavery. And yet, in recent decades, of course, there have been all kinds of Catholics on the forefront of making changes in the laws, opposing the remnants of slavery in the forms of laws that you know, that still oppressed African Americans in this country. There are issues right now that are being dealt with and may seem like they may seem intractable or insurmountable, but I think slowly over time, you know, changes do occur. We in the Roman Church, I think, have have this perspective that of looking at things from a longer standpoint. The wheels turn slowly, but they grind very fine, and we remain optimistic. I think that our church and all people of goodwill, regardless of the religion, are moving slowly, you know, if gradually, toward to the common good that we all sense and we have articulated here today. I think, you know, Martin Luther King said the curve of history bends. Maybe you know it better than I do. Curves slowly but inexorably toward justice. So that's my hope.
Very good. Anyone else want to take a shot at that one? Okay, we'll go to you, and then over to you, George. Yes, please.
I can tell you a story about that. But I won't take up your time. We do play bingo, yes.
Actually, bingo in Utah is illegal if there's a prize offered for winning. So all of those rest homes, senior citizen homes, they're all criminals. They're all criminals. In fact, I recall once when Scott Matheson got picked up as governor, down buying a raffle ticket at the Guadalupe Center. And he called me in the middle of the night. Now, when Scott was going to be amicable with me, he called me Ted. And he said, "Mayor?" I said, "Yes, yes, Scott." He says, "You got some young cop down here giving me a ticket for buying a raffle ticket." I said, "What number is it?" He said, "Number 3. I said, I bought number 1 this morning." So, and it made the papers, and it became a big issue. Well, the upshot of it was that Cal Grondahl did a cartoon for the Deseret News. He was at the Deseret News at the time. And it had a cop patrol car out in front of a Mormon ward, a cop with a bullhorn with his weapons drawn, a sign on the ward that says Relief Society Raffle, and the cop is saying, "Sisters, come out with your quilts up." We did have the recent issue of pari-mutuel betting four or six years ago. Church jumped in with both feet on that one. Any comments on that?
You know, I would like to respond back to this question that this gentleman asked. And, you know, you mentioned the issue of gun control and the fairly clear statement of the LDS Church regarding guns in schools and churches.
And I think that's interesting because here you have the church who has come out and said, not only do we not think that guns belong in churches, but we don't want to put up signs either. And the way the current statute reads, they basically have to post some kind of a sign and give you or give you verbal warning in advance to have it be effective. And my view is that it's just the opposite. If somebody wants to bring a weapon into the church or wants to bring a weapon into my home, they have an obligation to tell me they are about to do so and seek permission to do so. And what's interesting is that I think the response to that has been, let's see if we can avoid the question. Let's see if we can avoid ever having it come up so that we don't have to make this very difficult choice. And so I think you're seeing the majority leadership of the legislature dragging their feet to avoid a special session at all costs. I think they're going to avoid having this issue even come up in the January session, if they can possibly do so. But they are very concerned about an initiative petition process, which is unfolding. And so it's going to be an interesting dynamic. But clearly, you've got people in the legislature that are at odds because they see, on the one hand, here's my church leadership pronouncing something. On the other hand, here is this the secular leadership of the NRA pronouncing another thing, and they are just torn. It's absolutely astounding. Yes, well. Yeah, I think you just answered my
puzzle. It's the Old Testament versus divine revelation, huh? Ron, we got to hear from Ron Mullen on this one. Then I'll go to you, sir, right in front of him. Ron Mullen, I hope Ron and Norma, I can share with the audience that they had a son brutally killed by a gun a number of years ago, and they've been very strong advocates for gun control and great citizens in that regard.
Gun violence meets monthly at the Catholic diocese.
Right, okay, at the Catholic diocese. All right, very good. Would any of you like to make a comment regarding Ron's comment? That's okay, we'll get to those questions. I think the man and the gentleman with the ball cap on is next, but do you want to respond to that, Catherine?
I just have a couple of issues because I notice as the questions come up, we get into the issues that adults can talk about, the gay rights issue. We have two sides to that issue. And again, to get back to the child care issue and what Mike said about that the Catholic Church, the wheels move slow, but it's fine-tuned. I find this in my history with the LDS Church as well because if you remember, we used to have a relief society during the week, and the moms would go, and there was a nursery there. Guess what? We don't have that anymore unless it's in the evening or on Saturday. Because women were in the workforce, the church made an adjustment. Because the women had a voice. And so, Reverend, I guess that's what I'm saying to you is that, yes, I think we hear the voices we want to hear, and adjustments do come very slowly. And, again, on my soapbox, I'm saying the gun issue relates so directly to children. The Relief Society, everything we're doing in this session today, every topic we've talked about, gambling, we've talked about every issue relates to our children because they're growing up into that. So I'm just going to tweak your minds to say as we talk about any of these issues, please, I'll probably raise my hand and say, think about the child. Think about the child.
Thank you.
Just real quick, also along the lines with guns, not only has there been a clear declaration from the church on that issue, I believe the public's already also made a clear declaration. The Dan Jones poll that I saw said 87% oppose guns in schools, 82% oppose it in higher education. And I know that that's an issue that students at the University of Utah are very concerned about, along with the Board of Regents. And it is something we will be speaking more about in the near future.
I'll tell you why the NRA has such power, speaking from a personal vantage point. When I ran for mayor in 1975, I took the normal Utah politician line on guns. I'm not for gun control that takes away our hunting rifles and our right to go out and shoot birds and animals and all of that. That's about all I said. It was not a big issue that year in the mayor's race. However, right after I was elected, it was on Rod Decker one night, and of course he doesn't let you get off the hook too easily. He kept boring in on me on that issue, and he finally said, what about these little cheap handguns you can buy for $45 downtown, and you can just go shoot somebody with them? They won't shoot a bird. They're not accurate enough, but if you're close to somebody, you can kill them with it. Saturday Night Specials are called. I said, in that case, Specifically in that case, I would be for control of those Saturday night specials. By 7 days later, I had 10,000 cards in my office from the NRA from all over the Intermountain West. They were all a card that had been mailed out to individual NRA members, and they had all signed their name and written various unadoring things on them and sent them to my office. And it has a chilling effect on you. So the NRA's power comes, it's not ecclesiastical, even though Moses is a member. It's more just that they can turn the guns on so hard and so fast. And the Eagle Forum does the same thing. So if you want to win on the gun issue, you develop the same techniques on the other side, I suppose. But it's hard because the kind of venom that the gun owners get to is based more on general. I think it's less an issue of guns and more an issue of individual freedom, and that sort of thing goes deeper. It's like abortion or other key issues.
The difference today is it's email. Yeah, we get tons.
Email.
Just tons.
Oh yeah, they don't want regulation of anything short of a tank or an automatic weapon. They'll go for the automatic weapon ban, which is a federal law. But that's where the dividing line is, because their theory is if you allow regulation in any form, any kind, not even the Teflon bullets, which will pierce body armor that the police wear, they don't even want regulation of those, even though they have no relevance to hunting. Hunting, you use a soft tip bullet to expand and kill the animal. They even want the Teflon bullets unregulated, because their theory is that any regulation leads to more. So they're pretty hard-nosed about that. Sir, you are next. Come to you, and then I think I saw you, George, next after that. Good question for Dave Jones, I think. Is the special session dead now?
I don't think it's dead yet, but it's mortally wounded, and I think it's looking tough. The thing that, you know, I had a press conference a couple of weeks back and kind of chastised my majority colleagues for doing what I consider to be the Michael Jackson. You know, you look like you're moving forward, but you're really moving backwards. And it made him really mad. I got taken to a couple of woodsheds on that. But, you know, I think that's what's happening. If you consider the progress of this issue, we have the Columbine, the president of the LDS Church come out and call for something. Then the governor starts to get on board. And then the governor calls for a 30-day review. The legislature then follows up with a 90-day review. And the 90-day review is just about up. And now we're going to go out and we're going to do statewide hearings. And we can't have a special session in August because it's a bad month. Everybody knows that. We can't have a special session in September because the legislature has a site visit planned for someplace. October, maybe. But, you know, if you get into October, shouldn't you just wait till the January session when everybody's back? And, you know, why have a special session at all? So what I think is happening is a real foot dragging. They wanted to look like they were doing something and being serious about it, and I don't think they're doing anything. And more, it looks to me like they're not willing to do this. Marty Stevens has said publicly in the newspaper that he will not put the issue of guns in schools and churches on the floor of the House of Representatives unless he has 38 signatures on a piece of paper saying that they'll vote for it. And 38 is what it would take to pass this. So clearly they're divided, and I think the Republicans rightfully see this as a big wedge issue that's going to hurt them a lot. But I think they are not paying attention to what the public's in this case. And you'll probably see them come forward with an initiative, a legislatively passed referendum, in other words, to put on a ballot to try to defuse the citizens' initiative. And we've seen that once before. We saw the legislature try to preempt a citizens' initiative, and that was when they were dealing with term limits. And the legislature came in and did term limits. Remember that? And Merrill Cook had his thing on the ballot. Well, the legislature passed term limits, and then last session, they repealed it. Almost, you got very little press, but they repealed it. And so that's kind of how the game works sometimes. If you can just drag it out long enough, people forget about it and, you know, look like you're doing something, but don't really do anything. That's what's going on. No more moonwalking. That's right.
George? Go to George, and then I think I saw you next, John. And then.
Is that okay if I change the direction of the discussion a little bit towards
sure.
something that I wanted to discuss that was kind of on my mind? I'm kind of one of the few members of the LDS Church that's active in the Christian Coalition. It's a Virginia-based, you know, and they've done their best to support their own agendas and their own candidates and whatever they have on their minds that's for their cause. I think they just lost their tax-exempt status and so on because of some of their behavior up there. And, you know, I went to a Christian Coalition conference up in Washington, oh, I think a couple of years ago when this young Ralph Reed was heading this thing up. And to corner him is like cornering God yourself and God himself. I mean, you know, he's everybody wanted a piece of this young guy. You know, I mean, he just had no time. But I fortunately had 30 seconds with him on his way out somewhere, you know, on his busy life. And I says, how come there's not more LDS involved in your group? And he says, well, we're interested in soliciting, or whatever his words were, in encouraging evangelicals and Christians, which I thought was an interesting comment because I thought, well, you know, his thinking of Mormons is entirely different from mine. But now we've got a candidate, of course, that is LDS that wants to run for, you know, a pretty high office here. And I think we're going to have to bring in closer alliance, you know, our status locally with some of these Eastern Belt organizations that have a completely different idea about who we are and who we stand for. And I think this is going to have to close the gap because of what's happening here. Otherwise, we're just not going to get the support locally that we need on a grassroots level. But my main question, and this has been a concern of mine for many years, is that there's an organization, a branch of the church called the Latter-day Saint Foundation, and I think an arm of that is kind of an endowment organization where, you know, they give to the arts organizations and things like that. They give to ballet. No, I don't know if they – I don't know. You're going to have to – But my concern has been that I think I don't know where they appropriate the funds, whether it's appropriated out of our tithe money or not. I'm not against ballet itself. I don't see where local ballet will benefit people in.
George, you need to get to your question.
In Bangladesh or something. But see, I'm trying to.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Well, I would hope so. I would hope so. Because, you know, I'm one that wants to see the abolishment of the NEA. I think that, you know, arts is ambiguous. It's an interpretive word.
George, you need to get to a question.
Well, my question is that I would like to know what... Well, I'd just like to get your opinion about, you know, what we could do as far as the LDS Foundation and, you know, how they can more meet the needs of us locally, because I don't think generally it serves our purpose. The Latter-day Saint Foundation, they give to things like Sundance Institute, for example, which, you know, I feel might not always have the best, the things that the, you know.
Hey, you called me a couple of years ago and asked me to help you get into their reception.
Well, I mean, that's.
Oh, no, I'm just putting you on the spot.
That wasn't my question.
Oh, okay. Thanks, George. Does anyone want to respond to the question about the
George,
LDS?
George, I hear what you're saying, and I see this type of thing going on. If we support the NEA, then we can't support something else. Variety is the spice of life, and it isn't a matter of not doing one in order to do another. It's a matter of trying to figure out how we can do it all and do it well. If we didn't have culture in our community right now, whether you go or you don't go, I mean, I don't go to the hockey games all the time, and I'm sure as heck glad we have it here for some of our people who want to do it. So I guess I would take issue with your position and say that all of these things need to be thought about.
Very good. John, do you have a question?
Yeah,
a few.
It's helpful.
I felt kind of funny following that question because I, as a Mormon Democrat, I'm very much opposed to aligning ourselves at the grassroots level or any level with the religious right or the Christian Coalition. But my question is a little bit different from the latter, so I'm changing the subject to an issue that I have a lot of feelings about, namely abortion and pro-choice and pro-life dichotomy. As most of you know, the official position churches against abortion, but I've always felt that there was kind of latitudes in how what type of legislation we should support and what type of political activity we should be engaged in. But now I find more and more, as I read pronouncements by general authorities, usually in unofficial capacities, that we're coming closer and closer to the religious right, and I'm very concerned about that. I, too, became a Democrat in light of my missionary experiences, but instead of dealing with the poor, I deal with unmarried women and lots of baptized four women that had abortions. Also, four women, those same women, were sexually abused. I don't see a lot of detail in the pronouncements of general authority about just what kind of punishment we're going to build into the legislation against abortion, just how we're going to deal with this politically. It's extremely vague if it's not even vacuous. And I personally just don't know where I should stand in light of what they say. And I still consider myself pro-choice, although in a very aberrant sense, perhaps, because I am against abortion as principle, but I am not for, you know, the typical political solutions that I typically hear from the religious right or the Republican Party. So,
thank
as
you.
A young Democrat, what are your feelings?
Okay.
Thank you very much.
As I've talked to different people about it, we as members of the church are in a tough situation because people who are pro-choice nationally will call us pro-life because the stand of the church on abortion is that abortion is acceptable in cases of rape, incest, or severe endangerment to the life of the mother. And the pro-lifers will say, therefore, we are pro-choice because we allow abortion in certain circumstances. So I believe that the stand of the church on abortion and what is acceptable and what is not acceptable, they have made very clear as far as legislatively or legally what the implications of that are. I believe the church is just, you know, is leaving that up to the lawmakers because, you know, as I've studied some of the legal implications of abortion, the Supreme Court, from what I understand, could not come out and unilaterally, either has to unilaterally allow or disallow abortion. They cannot come out and say, you know, in certain circumstances abortion is allowed because who is the federal government to decide that the quality of life of somebody who is conceived under circumstances of rape is not, you know, should therefore have their life terminated. I don't believe that's a decision that the federal government has to make. So the legal implications of the church's stance on abortion may implicate that, yes, the government should allow it, so therefore members of the church can make their decision whether they choose to have an abortion under these circumstances or not. If the federal government disallows abortion, then under all circumstances it is disallowed. So, I guess
The church made it pretty clear a few years ago, and I forget the circumstances exactly, and someone may remember it, that pro-choice Mormons would not have that used for or against them in the church. And to my knowledge, it's not in the bishop's questions to go to the temple, that's for sure. If they start on that question, they're going to have to ask a lot of others, I suppose. Yeah. However, I do think to make that distinction is not being regulated at this point by the church. So, David?
My question is Ebola in
Atlanta. Coca-Cola. That's good. You want to take a shot at that, Michael?
I've never lived in Boston, but I did live in New York City for 3 years. And you can't live in New York City without feeling the Jewish influence. I mean, it's in the culture, in the food that you eat. But you, of course, don't, in my experience, feel any sense of institutional involvement, not to the extent that you feel in Utah. But I think Utah is unique in that we are somewhat, you know, geographically remote from the rest of the country. We are out here in kind of in a desert. And you know, there's a saying that tall mountains make their own weather, and in this state, the LDS Church is a tall mountain. In New York, you'd find lots of tall mountains. The Jewish influence, I mean, the Italian influence, you know, the commercial influence, all of those influences. But I think we feel, and I never lived in Massachusetts, but I would say that I've lived there. I don't think I would agree with that analogy. Simply because the cultural milieu is so much different, I think, in that part of the country than it is here. You know, it's different living in a desert with one tall mountain than it is living on the coast with mountains and oceans and everything else. That would be my
I know of one case in Boston where at least a parish got directly involved with a parish priest, and that's when, Jenny, is it the red line? You remember the classic Kennedy case, the red line to Arlington? Is it Arlington? You can buy a paper from the John F. Kennedy School of Government. It's a case study called The Red Line to Arlington. It's when they put in the MTA, the Massachusetts Transit Authority Red Line, they wanted to go up all the way up to Arlington, and the parish priest up there was across the street from where this terminus would be, and he didn't want the traffic, he didn't want the noise, and so he totally got the church involved in that issue. Now, I don't think, as a priest, I don't think a Mormon bishop would use his ecclesiastical thrust in the same manner. He might do it as a citizen because he's a lay priesthood holder. But this Catholic priest got deeply involved and blocked the red line to Arlington. So at least in a specific case, you might find in Boston that priests do get involved, and I've seen other examples of it, do get involved more directly than Mormons might out here.
Yeah. I took them all.
Along with the Hindus and the Buddhists, and
I think in order to understand, you know, if that analogy may be correct or not, there's a difference between how the LDS culture has an impact on politics and the LDS institution. Culturally, I would believe that, you know, because we share a common belief, then we will take common stances on different issues. And that, in that sense, yes, the analogy holds in Utah as well as in New York with the Jewish population, as well as in Atlanta with the Southern Baptist. The difference comes in institutionally, where the Jewish faith does not have a hierarchical structure, whereas in the LDS Church we do. So in that sense, institutionally, I think it may not be correct, but culturally, we do have the analogy is correct.
We have time for one more. Reverend, you've had one shot, so I'm going to give it to someone else, unless you got another great story to tell. Okay. I'll go. I think I saw your hand, ma'am, some time ago, so I'm going to go back to you. Yes. Dave, you want to jump on that one? Okay, Catherine, pardon me.
Dave will know the name of the legislator that I'm referring to, but at the time we have grown, and as you'll see in this blue handout in 1998 and from the other myths and facts in the yellow handout that were created, the legislature had created a task force. Dave was involved with child care issues, trying to see that we had proper licensing for in-care homes so our children were protected. And in this last session, and I don't know all the details, and it's not enough time to go into it, the task force was disbanded. The man who, do you remember the name?